Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this week we are covering one of the greatest ghost ship mysteries of all time. Hands down.
Really?
Yeah.
Ghost ships.
Ghost ships.
I don't know. We don't have any like ghost crews on this one. It's just like a mass death.
I was asking people.
The great dying is what's going on.
I was the great dying. That is going to be the subtitle for this episode. It's going to be Uring Medain,
well,
the great dying.
The great dying is also like one of the most catastrophic extinction events in all of Earth history.
What?
So it's called the great dying. Yeah.
What?
Like 96% of all life on Earth died. Pretty great.
That is the greatest band name I've
great
ever
dying.
Heard. The great dying.
So edgy, bro.
Edgetastic. Yeah, so I was asking people, I was like, hey, do you have any like good ghost ships that you think would be good for us to cover and stuff? And I guess I didn't make my definition of ghost ship known and clear because people were like, the Flying Dutchman. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's more like
all
it.
Right. We might do an episode
that's what
on
I
the Flying
hear.
Dutchman one day. That'd be fun. But
let's
no.
just do, can I just do another Jason special on Blackbeard?
Sure, man.
Yes.
Yeah, dude, I think people would love hearing about pirates. It's not really paranormal at all, but that's okay.
Hey, he was spooky at the time.
He was spooky at the time. He's spooky now as he haunts my dreams.
Again.
Find some, like, Ghost of Blackbeard stuff to throw in there. Okay.
Sure.
All right, we got to tie it back somehow.
Ghost pirate ships.
There we go.
I watch a lot of Scooby-Doo for that. Don't worry.
There we go.
We'll get it nailed.
Yep.
We got it. And some Pirates of the Caribbean.
There we go. We're just going to do an episode on Pirates of the Caribbean.
This might be all fictitious.
But I think it's worth considering. Oh, no.
Because everything else we talk about is factual.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no. Now we're a parody podcast. Anyway. Yeah.
Pivot.
So, pivot. So, yeah, I was like, what's some good ghost ships? And people were like, the Flying Dutchman and the Black Pearl. And I was like, okay, for me, when I say ghost ship, and it's my fault that I didn't make this understood, when I say ghost ship, I mean a ship that's spooky. Like a spook ship is what I should have asked. And the Uring Medain, thank you all.
Say thank that you. Five times fast.
I won't. The Uring Medain is one of the creepiest, spookiest ghost ships of all time. Spook ships, as we're going to be referencing them going forward here.
No, we won't.
Yes,
you might. Will. I won't.
Spook ships. The spooktacular
Sweet.
Spook ships. Yeah, no, it's a great story, and it's like equal parts urban legend, and like maybe something actually happened, so that's what we're going to get into. That's what we're talking
oh,
about
goody.
Today.
I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah. Any preliminary thoughts?
It wasn't actually moving, right?
It was adrift.
Okay, so, like normal ghost ships.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing about ghost ships.
They just kind of
drift
float
away.
Around and do their thing.
The yeah. hula.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
All right, just making sure that there's some spooky driving going on. That's all I want.
As
Sam.
Long as there's a ghost at the wheel,
that's
we're fine.
Really all I care about.
That's really what it comes down to. Yeah, it's quite a story, so, all right, we'll just get into it here.
Yeah, Sam, hit
Sounds
me.
Sounds good. All right.
Tell me about this ghost ship of ours.
Do you want to say its name first?
Nope. I thought about it, and I decided otherwise.
All right, that's fair. So, the story of the Uring Medain, that's how we're going to be pronouncing it, one way or the other. It begins in June of 1947. Now, the Medain was believed to be a Dutch freighter, essentially a cargo ship, that was traveling in the Strait of Malacca, which was between Singapore and Malaysia. They sent out a distress call over... Is it a telegraph? That's what it is, right?
They used Morse code, wasn't it?
Yeah, they used Morse code. So that would be the deet, 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 deet.
Correct.
Okay, cool.
Every time I, like, think of that, my mind instantly jogs back to Balto.
Okay. All right.
Where they're sending the Morse code telegram.
Okay.
Like, that's the and only like, thing
we
I
need
see.
The medicine.
Exactly.
And Balto's like, I'm taking him that medicine.
Yeah. So, Balto was like, so that good. Sequence of transferring the telegram is the only thing that pops in my mind when I think of Morse code.
That's fair. I always think of YYZ by Rush, because it's like the it starts with like a symbol or like a really high note. And that corresponds to, like, a Morse code thing. It's really cool, yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah. I like it. Anyway, so...
I liked Balto.
We can watch
Sorry.
It. Anyway, so the distress call is sent out in Morse code from the Ouring Mandang, and it's picked up by Dutch and British listening posts, as well as some merchant ships that are in the area. Now, the message comes through as follows. It's super spooky. And it's beautiful. All officers, including the captain, are dead, lying in the chart room and bridge, possibly whole crew dead. I die.
All right, Shakespeare.
And then it just...
Calm down a little bit.
The message just cuts
gone.
Off. Yeah, it's gone. Now, the following comes to us from the United States Coast Guard and their publication, The Proceedings of the Merchant Marine Council. In that document, they talk about the first ship that was responding to the distress call, and it was an American merchant ship called the Silver Star. The story found in The Proceedings of the Merchant Marine Council are also corroborated by accounts from a local Dutch newspaper called The Locomotive. It took a few hours for the Silver Star to reach the source of the distress call, believed by the listening post to be this Dutch freighter, the SS Ouring Mandang. As the Silver Star approached, they saw absolutely no activity on deck, and the ship appeared to be adrift in the waters. As they boarded the ship, they noticed an immediate drop in temperature. Although the weather outside was around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, on the ship it felt almost chilly, especially below deck. The other terrifying thing they noticed upon entering the ship were the corpses. There were dozens and dozens of corpses littered above and below deck. And upon examination, there was no apparent cause of death that could be identified by the crew of the Silver Star. Same thing with the ship. There was no damage to it, no holes, nothing broken that they could tell. And these bodies, there were no wounds, there was no blunt force trauma, there was no signs of poisoning or anything like that. Their bodies weren't swollen, beaten, battered, anything. It literally looks like they just dropped dead, right where they were standing for no reason at all. But
any signs of rigor mortis?
I think that there was rigor mortis because...
Okay, it's been a while.
Yeah, it had been a few hours at least.
Right.
It took them... I'm pretty sure it took them close to 6 to 8 hours, even being the closest ship, to get to the Ouring Mandang.
Okay, yeah, that's in plenty enough time.
Yeah. So what they did notice, though, is that the arms of the corpses were kind of raised above them, as if they were shielding their head or their face from something. And when they looked a little closer, they noticed that the faces of all of the people were terrified. Like they had died with a look of complete fear on their face. And this is a quote from the Proceedings of the Merchant Marine Council that states, "Their frozen faces were upturned to the sun, staring as if in fear. The mouths were gaping open and the eyes staring." And they're like, oh, okay.
That's weird.
This is weird.
That's not normal.
This is strange. they...
It's really not normal how their arms did not flop down to their sides.
I know.
Dying too.
I know. I agree completely. It's extremely weird and strange, but they weren't able to find any single thing that would have caused any of this. The arms, the faces. They even found, it was said, they found the ship's dog, and it was laying dead, but its face was snarling. Like it was angry and trying to defend something from someone.
It's typically what a snarl means.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome. Over-explaining. That's my master's degree.
That's your jam.
There we go. Everything seemed to be where it should be. The captain was on the bridge. The officers' bodies were found in the wheelhouse in the chart room. The communication officer was slumped over the telegraph from where he had sent that message. But the other strange thing that they noticed was that the corpses appeared to be decaying much more quickly than they should have. Even the communications officer, who was confirmed to be alive just a few hours ago, was showing significant signs of decomposition. Now, as they're exploring, they're pretty much all back up to the top deck, and they notice smoke starting to come out of the underbelly of the ship. It's coming out of, to be specific, I don't know what this means, somebody might, the number 4 hold of the ship. So they decide, okay, we got to get off the ship. They hightail it back to theirs. They tie a tow line to ideally bring it back in with them. And suddenly there's just this great explosion that happens. And it was said that it exploded with such force that the ship came up out of the water for a moment and then crashed back down and just immediately sunk. And they had to cut the tow line before they were taken down with them. And no remains have ever been found. They didn't find the ship. They haven't found any bodies or anything like that. But that's
just perfectly disappeared.
That's the basic story of the Urang Medan. So what are you thinking from here, Jason?
Well, embellishment. Just a little bit. I mean, for me, one of the telltale signs is how it exploded. Because if there is an explosion, it would not explode that direction. Because explosions, it'll break, fissure, or whatever, at essentially the path of least resistance.
Okay.
And when you have the pressure of the water pushing back on the hold itself, it's going to have more resistance than going up.
Okay.
So the fact that there is enough force to push down instead of going up through where you have manholes, things like that, the explosion itself seems a little exaggerated.
A little far-fetched,
to say the least.
So you're saying that on a physics level, it wouldn't.
No, it can't
go
do that.
Down, which the force would go down, meet with the water, cause the boat to go up, right?
No. So what I'm saying
is
that
not possible.
When something, it's not possible because again, when something explodes, it's going to be exploding on a path of least resistance. The water pressure alone is essentially reinforcing the lower half of the hull.
Okay.
So when you have that extreme amount of energy, it would not explode and go down to push it up. It would explode through the top.
Okay. All right. Okay. So it does make physical sense. Okay. I could dig that.
So that alone is like, I'm not quite too
weird.
Sure what you talking about. But I will suspend further for later.
Okay.
But that alone, it makes me start to think that, well, maybe it is, again, a seed of truth.
Right. Within
sprouting into a tree of legend.
I asked him what he thought about the story before we started recording, and he started this rehearsed, like he was giving a monologue
seed
from Shakespeare or something.
Into a sapling of, what was it? Embellishment.
There we go.
Growing into a tree of legend.
There we go. All right. I like that. Okay. That's totally fair. And one of the things about the Urang Medan is that it's such a heavily disputed thing. You know, in addition to, obviously, the biggest question is, what happened? Like, especially what happened to these people? They're found dead for absolutely no reason. Their faces are covered in fear. They're in defensive positions. Like, what is going on here? That's the first big question. But the second big question that's always associated with it is, did this even happen at all? You know, is it...
Right. And it's a little tough because this happened mid-1900s.
Yeah.
Which, at that point in time, we're not talking about, you know, sails.
Right.
And a wooden boat any longer. We're talking about a metal ship.
Right.
And I'm assuming probably a fairly experienced crew.
Which you would think so.
So it's a little bit far-fetched to just assume that these men didn't know what they were doing and something went wrong due to lack of knowledge and things like that. Now, I have heard of, like, fairly recent ghost ships to where the driver, the I guess, captains and the whole crew are missing. But usually, at least for modern terms, it's one or two-man crews.
Right, where they're, it's not, you know, dozens of
people. It's a solo pilot going around the world, and it might seem not like such a crazy and horrible place, but the ocean is...
Terrible.
Absolute. Like, there are so... You have to be very, very careful.
Right. I can dig that.
And so for, you know, these modern ghost ships of just one or two-man crews up and vanishing, that makes a whole lot more sense. Doesn't make a ton of sense on a bigger merchant craft.
All right.
With a crew that is probably a little bit more well-experienced than, you know, a single person.
Right. I dig that completely. And that is, that's... Part of the mystery is, in addition to what happened, you know, is it even real? And there's enough, for me personally, there's enough on both sides. We have, like, evidence.
It's very thought-provoking.
Yes, that's for sure. We have evidence on one side, and we have, like, a great theory on the other side.
I mean, it's... An interesting theory.
It's an interesting theory. So,
and we'll get to that theory shortly.
Well, and we're going to go into some of the evidence on the other side of, did it happen at all? Maybe not.
Right. So, and when I was going through the notes, I'm like, oh, look, Sam did all my work for me. I appreciate that.
I was going to, like, try to maybe cover it up. Not cover it up, but just, like, not bring it up, not talk about it. And I was like, that's not doing justice to the story. That's not being fair to our listeners. Like, we need to cover this in every detail that we can. So... Here's that evidence. Okay, so some people will point to the fact that the ship is not registered in the Lloyd's Shipping Register, which was a compendium of all merchant ships in the water weighing 100 tons or more. In theory, the Medan definitely should have been there. The Lloyd's Shipping Registries was the first ever grading system for boats. So you had like an A1 boat because it was the top... construction for the body and the top construction for like the sails and the masts and the engine and all of that. Yeah. Oh, they started a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
Yeah. No.
So who runs that?
It's a company now called just Lloyd's Registers.
Okay.
Yeah. It's still
so it's
around.
Privatized?
Yeah. It's totally privatized. But that's where like the expression A1 comes from, you know, when people talk about like A1 being a high grade of whatever, like A1 steak sauce.
Really? It came from that?
That comes from that. Yeah.
Isn't that's that a cool tidbit.
There we go. A little bit of a fact for you.
Love it. The rest of this is complete BS.
But that's our truth to this matter. So they also then checked. They said, okay, it's not in Lloyd's Shipping Registries. That doesn't look great, but... They checked with the registry in Sumatra as well, because the name of the ship, Urang Medan, is translated into the man from Medan. Medan is the largest city on the island of Sumatra. And so they thought, okay, maybe it's out of there.
And, right, that's believable.
Logical. They didn't find anything there either. Nothing in their ship's registry records. They talk about the ship being... a Dutch freighter and being captained by the Dutch, and I couldn't find exactly where they come up with that conclusion. Like, I, in theory, they can't find it anywhere on any registries. Everyone on the ship is dead. The ship has an Indonesian name, so I don't know why they think it's Dutch, but they do think it's Dutch. They check there. Nothing there. And
well, I mean, the Dutch did have one of the largest shipping companies during...
The Dutch
colonization
East Indies, time. Yeah.
So it's not far-fetched to think that maybe it might be a Dutch ship.
Totally.
Especially because, if anyone else isn't claiming it.
So that makes sense. They check in the Netherlands. They check all up and down that Swedish, Denmark, Netherlands, Norway, all of that area.
Northern Europe.
Northern
there
Europe.
There we go.
That entire area. And they don't find anything there either. And when I say they, I'm talking primarily about people closer to the modern day who are trying to find out about this. There's no evidence that can be seen there. The weirdest part of it, and the part that for me is like, okay, maybe this is a hoax, is that there are actually newspaper articles from 7 years earlier in 1940, and the articles tell a very similar story with some key differences. The original story contains a different SOS message with the operator of the telegraph asking for a warship, for assistance by a warship.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when they board the ship, the bodies, they're dead without wounds, just like in the modern version, but they don't have like a look of terror. They don't have that tidbit about the dog. The ship does explode, but it's also in a completely different place. It's off of the southeast part of the Solomon Islands. So it's like similar, but different as well in its own way. But even going back then, and going back to the 1940s, you still can't find any, or to 1940 itself, you still can't find any evidence in any of the registries that it existed or anything like that.
So what you're telling me is that we need to go take a vacation and hop on a submarine?
Yeah. No.
And go find it?
No. I'd never want to go on a submarine. That sounds terrifying. I've been on a submarine before. It was terrifying.
It was great.
No.
Why is it terrifying, Sam?
Because you're under the ocean in a tiny metal tube.
There's glass, too.
It's scary.
You got to see outside, didn't you?
I did. It was terrifying.
Okay. Well, stop making that face. All right.
All right.
Let's continue here. So, I will board a submarine and go search for that ship.
You still need to go to Australia. Okay.
I know.
Our Australian fans want you there. They want to take you to your hero's zoo, Steve Irwin's
zoo. I want to go to the
zoo.
Just the Australian zoo. It's plain and simple. Yeah. Anyway.
So the last piece of evidence, though, is a disclaimer that is attached to the 1948 publishing within that Dutch newspaper we were talking about, the one called The Locomotive. And it states, it was released in three parts, the story was. It states, this is the last part of our story about the mystery of the Ourang Medan. We must repeat that we don't have any other data on this mystery of the sea, nor can we answer many of the unanswered questions in the story. It may seem obvious that this is a thrilling romance thrilling romance of the sea. On the other hand, the author, Sylvia Shirley, assures us of the authenticity of the story. So, right there, you have literally the newspaper that published it being like, this doesn't seem like it's on the up and up.
This is a fun story.
This is a weird, yeah. This is probably just a typical romance of the sea. Exactly. It's like pulp. You know, it's for pulp magazines and stuff like that. There was no ability. Nobody reached out. Couldn't find the Sylvia Shirley. Unable to...
Probably a pen name, dude.
Yeah. Well, and unable to say, you know, how did you find about it? Anything like that. The other big thing is that the crew of the Silver Star... Completely impossible. The Silver Star was a real ship.
Okay.
So that part is at least true.
Awesome.
But the crew of the Silver Star, impossible to track down, and no one ever came forward. We don't have a first-hand account other than, like, this story that's published in the newspaper and, like, whoever reported it to the proceedings of the Merchant Marine Council, but that might even be a second-hand source there. So we don't have, like, that definitive... This guy said this happened, and we can go check with him.
I'm a little surprised we didn't have photos either.
Yeah, yeah. 1948, 1947, we had cameras.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had cameras back in the Civil War. Yeah.
Exactly.
There we go.
Real quick, the Silver Star, what kind of ship was that?
So the Silver Star was interesting because it was a merchant ship that was named something completely different, and then it was... what's it called? Conscripted during World War II.
Okay.
So it was like a merchant ship, but it was modified to have like guns and stuff like that. So
sweet.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. It was pretty neat.
It's a little sleeper.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't think it's like
it's a merchant ship over there. Oh no, it has guns.
They got guns. Anyway, so However, okay, like I said, we got two sides.
Yeah.
We got all that evidence over yep. there. And then we have the other side, the good side, the Roy Bainton side. So there's one man, at least, that I could find. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's multiple people. But one man who has spent years trying his best to track down the truth of the Orang Medan, and his name is Roy Bainton. And he put forward one of the best theories, in my opinion, regarding the truth of the Orang Medan. So, I am very happy to announce that we, here at Not Alone Podcast, are doing our first ever step towards government conspiracy. It took us 27 episodes to get here.
I'm not involved in that we.
This is a completely separate thing. You are involved in the we because I'm going to cut that out and no one's ever going to hear you say that. So, there is one man, however, who spent years trying his best to track down the truth of the Orang Medan. And his name is Roy Bainton, and he has put forward, in my opinion, one of the best theories regarding the truth behind the Orang Medan. Now, in addition to the searching of the aforementioned sources of naval information, he himself also did a lot of legwork. He contacted the Royal Admiralty of the United Kingdom, the Registrar of Shipping and Seamen, and the Natural Maritime Museum, as well as the Dutch Shipping Archives in Amsterdam. He went all the way to Singapore, searched the archives of their maritime authority, and he couldn't find a single thing about
it. You don't say.
Not a single shred of evidence, but...
Until...
So he's about at the end of his rope until he's contacted by this individual called Professor Theodor Seersdorfer of Essen, Germany, who's been investigating the case for around 50 years. Seersdorfer pointed Bainton towards a booklet by a German named Otto Mielke. The booklet was titled Death Ship in the South Sea, and it was a wealth of information. I mean, it described the technical details of the ship, the route, the engine power, the tonnage, all of that, as well as gave like a registry of the people on the ship, the name of the captain, stuff like that. And by all accounts, it should have been a treasure trove of verifiable, confirmable information. But Bainton could not reason and couldn't understand why, with all of this information he got here from this auto, from this booklet by Otto Mielke, why he could not verify any of it with any shipping
authority.
Like
who the captain is.
Yeah.
Was he able to even find any record of these people?
I don't believe he was able to verify anything within it. Like, any record of the people, the places, the route, anything like that. So, and it does. It's very disheartening. With the help of Mielke's booklet, though, he came to the realization in his mind that there was something a lot more sinister going on here. A lot spookier and terrible than what we first assumed. Because your traditional explanation for this incident, they vary greatly. I mean, you have people who are like, it was aliens. And the aliens came and they death rayed them, and that's why they look so scared and they were
totally
doing this. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the aliens.
Why not?
And the aliens sunk the ship, which, hey, if that's what you believe, I am not disparaging you at all. That's fine, because on a crazy freaking mystery like this, sometimes aliens are the only answer. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
There's something wrong with all of that.
Hey, now.
Take us in to the conspiracy land, okay. Sam.
Now, you have the alien explanation. Other people claim, and it's not that far-fetched, that the ship was boarded by, like, pirates.
That's fair.
Other people claim it was boarded by ghost pirates, which is...
That's much better.
Even better. But you come into the same problem with that, which is, if it was boarded by pirates, why are there no wounds? Like, why were these people not shot or stabbed or beaten to death? You know, why did they just drop dead? So, there's also the idea that it was, like, a fire in the boiler room, and there was, like, carbon monoxide that came up and choked everybody out, and then the ship exploded.
Oh, hey, that sounds Reasonable.
Right. The other one, right? Surprisingly reasonable.
Oh, hey, I can see how that could happen.
The other really well-accepted theory, and totally possible theory, is that a bubble of methane came up from a fissure in the bottom of the ocean and interacted with the ship, kind of encapsulated the ship for a time, which caused everybody to choke out. And then, because that methane had gotten into the holds, it then interacted with, like, the boiler room, the furnace, and that caused the great explosion. That is one of the better natural causes, sort of.
It's a bit more believable than aliens.
It's just a tad. Just a tad bit more believable than aliens.
Also, you know, that also explains their faces.
Right.
You know, they've been choking.
They know that they're choking to death. Yeah, exactly. And so that's a good.
On a poisonous gas, which also makes sense that their bodies might look unnatural.
Undisturbed, yeah.
Well, as far as decay goes.
Right, right.
If it's, you know, never mind. We'll continue.
No, yeah, totally.
There's more in the next little bit here that can also kind of lean in that same direction. That.
Exactly. So those are all great theories, but they're not the greatest theory.
And dun, 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 dun.
So, like I said, government conspiracy. Let's get into it. If you are averse to, like, really messed up stuff, you might not want to listen to this, because this is one of the most messed up things I've ever heard of.
It's pretty messed up.
Yeah. So Bainton suggests that the true cause of the mystery, the absence of the ship from any historical registers, the scant amount of detail, the earlier article that was introduced, all of this was intentionally orchestrated to be confusing, difficult to pin down, difficult to find any real information on. And he traces this mystery back to a unit of the Imperial Japanese Army, which was responsible for tens of thousands of deaths and a laundry list of war crimes. This unit was called Unit 731. It was also referred to as the Den of Cannibals.
Fun.
Great band name.
Gosh.
Unit 731, again, if you're weak in the stomach, I might kind of just skip past this part. Unit 731 was a covert biological and chemical warfare research and development unit that operated during World War II, as well as primarily during the Second Sino-Japanese War, which was a conflict between China and Japan.
And when did that take place?
It took place like the same time as World War II. It was like 1938 to 1945.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they kind of just rolled it all into one big war, and they're like, we're just at war with everybody right now. It's going to be fine. That's how the Japanese sounded in 1940.
I believe.
Hey! All right. Unit 731 was set to receive prisoners of war from both of these conflicts, but the majority of test subjects were Chinese men, women, and children. They did have some allied forces. They had some, like, political dissenters at home as well, native Japanese people. And the cover story was that the facility was a lumber mill. The scientists that worked there were actually experimenting on human test subjects. And what's kind of messed up is they would write papers about what they found and submit them to, like, peer-reviewed journals. But obviously, if they were like, oh yeah, we did this test on a human being, people would be like, wow, that's super messed up. So he was just like, we tested this on primates, on a short-tailed primates.
Seems legit.
Yeah. And everyone was like, wow, they're doing such crazy work on those primates, without realizing that the primates were human beings. And their subjects would be exposed to all sorts of just torture. And one of the popular things that would happen was human vivisection.
Ooh.
Which is basically a living dissection.
Oh.
Performed without anesthesia, without anything. So there's that. They would, yeah. They would cut off limbs of people to study blood loss. Just to, like, time it. Okay, cut off his arm, let's see how long it takes him to bleed out. It was truly awful. Like, it was truly terrible. They were also subjected to biological warfare, chemical warfare agents, testing. the female prisoners were forced into like pregnancies so that they could be experimented on, so they could see how it would affect unborn children. It was messed up. Like, I have more here, but I'm not going to read it because it's so terrible. However, after the end of the Second Sino-Japanese War and at the end of World War II, the compound was destroyed. They tried to torch it, but it was so well built that it didn't burn down. Like, it was all still, not all of it, but the majority of it was still there. And the Japanese were in this place, especially the people who ran this direct unit, were in this place where they were going to be prosecuted as war criminals and they were going to be executed, because what they did is 100% against the Geneva Convention, as well as just against, like, being a good, not totally deranged human being. However, this is when American general, and I'd like to point out, all of this is true. Like, this isn't the story of the ship, which is like, oh, maybe this happened. Like, this is all documented fact now. However, a general that I'm sure most of our American listeners are going to be familiar with, General Douglas MacArthur, stepped in and he said, hey, what if you didn't have to die and be executed for war crimes? What if you turn over all of your research, all of your findings, and all of your scientists to us, the American people and government, and we will make sure that nobody ever knows what happened here, and we'll make sure that nobody ever gets executed or prosecuted or anything like that. Now, of course, they totally accepted 100%, and in theory, all of their equipment, all of their biological chemical agents, their research. Now, of course, they accepted this and they went through with this deal. Now, Bainton found in Mielke's booklet a mention of potassium cyanide and nitroglycerin that was mixed and supposedly stored underneath the boat. Now, these two, I mean, with the chemical properties of these two, it explains everything that happened. It's one of the best non-natural explanations, because essentially, this potassium cyanide, all it needs is to interact with water or with carbon dioxide, and it will turn into hydrogen cyanide gas, which has a boiling point of 78.1 degrees Fahrenheit and is extremely poisonous. So if even just a little seawater got into the hold and into one of these containers, it would have triggered this immediately, as well as if that seawater combines with the nitroglycerin, it's going to make a huge, huge explosion. Now, Bainton speculated that due to the 1947 date of this occurrence, that the ship may have very well been headed for America to make good on the deal that was signed earlier. And this timeline matches up as well, because even though obviously World War II ended 1945, the prosecution of war crimes for Japanese officers and generals and the like, some of these prosecutions didn't happen until 1949. So it does line up with like the time that this deal possibly would have been struck, or the after effects of it. Now, the mixture was going to be taken by boat to avoid attracting attention. And this immunity that was granted, remember, it was super secret. So not only was it like, it wasn't just that people were like, oh, these people are war criminals, but it's fine. The idea was to not have anybody know what happened with Unit 731. And Bainton states regarding the movement of these materials, because he's not even sure whether or not other members of like the U.S. military or the executive judicial, you know, branches, legislative branch, don't know if anybody else really knew about it other than MacArthur. So he says, so how was this deadly cargo moved around the South China Sea and through the Straits of Malacca during this troubled period? Not by air, because the prospect of a cargo plane crashing with several tons of deadly gas on board was too horrendous to consider. No, you hired an insignificant old tramp steamer, preferably with a low-paid foreign crew, stowed the cargo in disguised oil drums, and like all serious smugglers, hoped for the best and a blind eye from authority. Like I said, if his theory is correct on this, all it would take was a little bit of seawater getting into one of those drums to create not only the hydrogen cyanide gas, but also to trigger the nitroglycerin explosion. Bainton proposes that in light of the Geneva Convention, which had been in effect for 20 years at that point, the deal that MacArthur made with the Den of Cannibals Unit 731 was completely and totally illegal. It would cause a public outcry and serious ramifications for anyone involved if it got out, and therefore the story was covered up. Shipping registries were changed, fake articles were planted, plausible deniability was introduced, and Bainton claims that the only reason that we know at all about it is because something escaped. He says, just like the gases escaped, this story escaped. In theory, it should just be another black project. It should just be another thing that we have no idea about. You know, kind of like Project Paperclip, how we didn't have any real idea that we were bringing Nazi scientists over for quite a while until a Freedom of Information Act. It should have been like that, but it wasn't, because this got out and it was just fantastical enough to seem like fiction. And so the powers that be, having had that released, did their best to make it just seem like a fiction. And that's the Orang Medan.
So we know for sure that MacArthur sent, signed off on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, there are everything about the ship.
Released documents have been, that's depressing.
It's super depressing.
I liked MacArthur before.
I know.
Because it's like, okay, I know you skimmed over exactly what the unit did.
Right.
But some of the things was like dosing and radiation and injecting animal blood and a whole lot of just weird stuff.
Yeah, bizarre.
That, at least to me, doesn't feel like something I'd hand out immunity for.
Right.
Like a lot of this weird testing, at least for myself, I wouldn't hold any value to.
Well, I think that the biggest thing about it that he was interested in was the chemical and biological warfare agents. Yeah, which are obviously outlawed by the Geneva Convention.
Right.
But it's like this thing where we can theoretically work on them we have these agents stored away in a vault literally under a mountain. And like we can take them out and work on them and experiment with them, but that sort of sharing of information, and especially in light of all of the human testing that was done and all the people who died, that's what makes it a war crime. Like you can sit and you can look at the virus and stuff, but you can't actually play with it and, you know, let it out. Yeah, it's 100% entirely confirmed, and it's super messed up and super sad. And it's not like Project Paperclip, where, like, for instance, Wernher von Braun, right? He was brought over from Project Paperclip. He's the father of modern rocketry. Created the V2 rocket, main reason that we're on the moon and all of that. A lot of those scientists were not great guys. Von Braun was one of those guys who was like, I really just want to make rockets. And
I mean, I don't blame him.
That's what I'm going to do. And you guys do your thing. And that information that they got was things like ballistics and weapons and stuff like that. But it was all okay under that Geneva Convention.
Right.
So that's why we know a lot about Project Paperclip and the exact names and like inventions that came over, but we don't know as much about Unit 731.
So from your description, MacArthur was the only person of knowledge on this?
The only person directly tied to it. Like the only person we can point at, MacArthur.
He's a U.S. general.
Right.
I mean, it's not like he doesn't have a ton of power, but it would be. It's mighty impressive being able to do this level of a cover-up between so many different nations and private companies as well. That makes me still a little unsure about it.
I dig it.
That being said, to me, I mean, I don't know much about nitroglycerin or the chemistry for it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it does seem to connect a lot of the dots.
Right?
Yes.
Crazy dots.
They are crazy dots.
I think what I like the most about that theory is how it can also, because, like, not to sound like a super crazy person. By the way, guys, if you're listening to this, I'm kind of feeling like maybe we want to do some more government conspiracies. If you're into that, let us know, because it's not our traditional format. It's not like our traditional way of doing things. So if you want it, let us know, and we'll probably do it. If you don't, we probably won't. We'll see. But the government has like a $61 billion budget for black projects, for secret science, secret weapons manufacturing, you know, and you look at the deals that like the CIA, the FBI has made throughout the years, like destabilizing dictators and things like that. It is not like, it is not completely unbelievable that we would make this super messed up deal and try to make this happen exactly how it was seemed. And then when we messed up, went back and tried to whitewash the records and all of that. Like, to me, as someone who dabbles in conspiracy thought, it's entirely possible. You know, I can't say whether it actually happened, but it's entirely
because
possible.
Right after the war, we essentially began the Cold War in a lot of ways. I mean, there becomes the arms race. So being able to have knowledge about biological testing and weaponry.
Yeah, it would have been super helpful.
Yeah, that's fair. A lot of covering up.
So what
a lot
do you,
of scrubbing.
Yeah, what do you think?
A lot of scrubbing.
What do you think?
I think it's weirdly coincidental that one German dude had this pamphlet.
Right, and that I couldn't find.
That detailed information
about
the ship and everything.
Unfortunately, I just didn't have the time to dig deeper into like the pamphlet where he got his information from and all of that either, other than it exists. Like, we know it exists, but that's about it.
And then, yeah, from the descriptions of at least the experiments that you've shown us about this unit, I don't see truly the value in having that information, at least not to the point where I would essentially pardon, you know, a whole group of scientists that did some really screwed up
really
stuff.
Really messed up stuff.
Because MacArthur also went on and helped actually write the new constitution for Japan as well.
Did he? See?
Which is a little weird if you're not the most ethical person.
Japan in post-World War II is crazy. Like, because you know their state religion.
Dude, Japan's always been kind of crazy.
Japan is always insane. Like, in a good way. Not like a terrible way.
No.
Not like bad. But, like, because in, this is totally a tangent, but, like, in their state religion, pre-World War II, their emperor, first off, they had an emperor.
Right.
And he was God, literally.
Right. Well, I mean, again, that's a theme that you see in most
monarchies. Then, after World War II, when they failed, he gave a radio address where he renounced his godhood. And he was like, I am no longer your god. And it's like, can you even imagine really buying into that and believing that and then sitting and listening to your god be like,
sorry,
dabbing out, there we go. Like, oh, it's so crazy. I think, yeah. So do you think, yeah, do you think it happened? Do you think it was aliens? Do you think it was this thing?
If anything, I think it was a freak accident.
Okay. All right.
It could have done with some weird cargo that they were carrying, but I think it was some sort of freak accident. And the story, just like a whole lot of stories, become more eccentric over time.
I think that's fair. I think that there's a definite level of embellishment in this. Like, you can see it and smell it and taste it. I think that the first thing that you pointed out was the ship like blowing out of the water and then going back in. That definitely seems like an embellishment. But like,
that is a lot of thrust.
It is a lot of thrust.
That is a lot of thrust to lift a metal ship vertically.
Right.
If
I was a more science guy, I could have like tried to calculate like X amount of nitroglycerin would have created this amount of thrust and it would have brought. But I'm not.
I mean,
so,
if there's anything I learned from Fast and Furious, NOS is powerful, but not that powerful.
All right, that's fair. Yeah, I want to say that I do think that something happened. Again, the only thing that I can't 100% like say, okay, it's explained, is that earlier account from 1940.
Right. A very, very similar story occurred to.
Wherein you then really all you would have to do in that case, though, is to change the narrative a little bit.
Right.
And say, okay, instead of them transporting the materials from America to Japan or from Japan to America, it was all just 731 doing its own thing. And it exploded and the Japanese government covered it up then. And then it resurfaced years later and the narrative got changed.
Right. But essentially, you have the core fundamental pieces, and then you just change the shell that's built around it.
Exactly, yeah. So,
and I mean, that is an easy way to, you know, fill in some pages on a newspaper.
Yeah, yeah, it's
a good story.
A good,
you know,
story. Yeah, that's the only part of it that I can't completely explain, and that's fine. I think that he's, with the limited knowledge, the cursory research I did on all of this, I think that the Unit 731 is the best explanation, and it's also the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, it's twisted.
But, I mean, Japan wasn't really doing very good things to China during that time period either.
Oh, yeah. You ever seen Ip Man?
No, was that in that period?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, like, totally the Rape of Nanking.
Yeah.
Yeah,
dude.
That kind of atrocity that Japan had done to China is not far-fetched.
No. No,
it's
totally not.
I just don't see the scientific benefit of most of that.
That's because you're not a deranged psychopath.
That's fair. That's fair. How do you know?
I mean, that's fair.
but yeah, it seems like you're just demonizing the enemy.
Right.
But even though they did really bad things and they demonized themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it though, the Nazis did similar things.
The Nazis did some bad stuff.
Yeah.
Stalin did some bad stuff. A lot of people's done some bad stuff. We didn't do some great stuff.
And it's because we
had our Japanese camps back in the 40s
the
too.
Internment camps, yeah. But I'd like
no
to
one
believe,
has a perfect past.
Yeah, no, but I'd like to believe that we didn't like do chemical, biological experimentation.
Right. No, I don't think so.
I don't think we did. We'll see about that though. Yeah, it's just like I agree that it's hard to see why would they do this, and then why would we as a nation be like, yeah, we want that enough.
That's valuable enough to grant immunity.
But, you know, it was, like you said, the Cold War came right on the heels of World War II. It was a scary time for everybody. Like, I could see that happening with our government, because it already happened with Project Paperclip. I mean, like I said, Wernher von Braun, he was an okay dude. Other people that were brought over with that were full-fledged Nazis. And, like, just given asylum because they had scientific research to contribute, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, it's weird. Let us know if you like the conspiracy stuff. I like the conspiracy stuff.
It was an interesting story, Sam. I appreciate you sharing with us.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for being here with me and saying things.
You're welcome.
It was good. Okay.
As long as I can undermine the story just in the slightest.
Just a little bit. Yeah, no, it was good. Cool.
Disbelieve a little.
I hate you so much.
I know.
So
what else we got going on today, Sam?
I got two shout outs I want to give. Ooh. On a show level. Because so one of them is this show called Historical Blindness that I've been listening to, and it's super great. So basically it's this fella named Nathaniel Lloyd. What he does is he looks at, I mean, like, this sort of subject would be pretty good for him. He looks at different misconceptions throughout history, different kind of, like, sort of mysterious or somewhat even mythological, like the Reichstag fire, you know, like, what really happened there? Did Hitler burn it down? Was it somebody else? All sorts of stuff like that. He just had this really great episode that's really, like, topical for the time about a guy named Joseph Mulhattan. And he's called the Liar Laureate of the World. And he was essentially this newspaper man who started, like, fake news. Like, all the way back in the late 19th century, he was one of the first people to be like, I got this newspaper. Who says I got to report the facts, huh? I can report whatever I want, yeah? And then he made all these hoaxes and all these different things. It's super fascinating. So go check out Historical Blindness. The other one that I wanted to talk to you about is one of our companions in the Dark Myths, and it is actually a show called Monsters Among Us. And essentially it's what I wanted this show to be, but we couldn't pull it off, and so I'm really proud of him for, Derek Hayes is his name, proud of him for pulling it off. It's a call-in show where people just call in, tell about the cryptids, the ghosts, the UFOs, the poltergeist activity, all this weird stuff that happens. It's basically Coast to Coast in its own little way. And it is full, I mean, it's full of some of the best, spookiest, greatest paranormal stories I've ever heard, because it's just average people calling in. And they call in, they tell the story, and then he kind of sits and he talks about it and then moves on to the next one. So It's super fascinating. I think we have a promo that I'm going to drop in here for it, so we'll do that.
In the shadowed recesses of our world, monsters lurk. Despite our reluctance to find them, an unlucky few cross paths. It's these experiences that we explore at Monsters Among Us podcast. My name is Derek Hayes. Each week, I explore calls from around the world detailing chilling encounters with mystery beasts, ghosts, UFOs, and a plethora of other strange happenings. You can find Monsters Among Us podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and most other podcatchers.
Also, guys, check out the Mad Scientist podcast. I was on an episode like a week ago talking about the Low Files, Rob Lowe's paranormal investigation show. And the plan right now, we missed a week, and I think we're missing another one because of like weird vacations and stuff. But the plan is for us to recap every single episode. So it was a lot of fun. Just go to the Mad Scientist podcast feed and look for the Lowdown, which is what it's called, which is a great title that Marie came up with. And also just check out the Mad Scientist because they're dope. Anyway, so go listen to those podcasts. They're both fantastic. The next thing we're going to do is call out our listener reviews. So we got two new reviews that are really nice. The first one is by Hamilton 1998. And the second one is by C1M2S5. So, thank you both.
Does not compute.
Does not compute. We're going to read the C1M2S5 one. He says, or they say. I always assume gender when it comes to reading reviews. I don't know what's wrong with me, man. Anyway, they say, I'm so happy I found this podcast. I absolutely love hearing about aliens and cryptids. Sam and Jason have such great chemistry and look forward to listening to every new episode, especially when I'm working at night. Keep up the great work, y'all.
Aww.
Thank you, C1M25S. I think that was it.
I love it.
I already exited out of iTunes there. So we didn't get any new patrons over the last 2 weeks. That's totally fine. If you are interested in supporting the show, head over to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. It's one of the best ways you can support us. You get access to some bonus content, some extra material, but at the end of the day, it's really you saying, hey, I value these guys as much as a cup of coffee, and so I'm just going to give up one cup of coffee a month and help them out. So if that sounds good to you, do it. If not, we still love you. You know, Baron. I'm going to leave that in. Baron just snorted into the microphone. If you all heard that, that wasn't Jason. That was Baron.
So he could say something.
He doesn't got anything to say.
All right.
So head over there. Check that out. If you would like to leave an iTunes review, that would super help us as well. You know, one of the other big things, the biggest thing you can probably do to help us out is just talk about us. Tell people about us. You know, your friend says, hey, I like spooky stuff. Be like, oh, I got the best spooky podcast. You know, full of the spooktacular. 100%. That's us.
Don't oversell us too much, though.
Don't set the bar so high that they're going to be disappointed. Okay, say like, oh, I know this podcast. They're fine. Do that. Say they're fine. Because that's really what it's all about, is just that word of mouth. And you guys have done so amazing at that already. And, you know, we've grown so much and we're so grateful. So you can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod, and Jason has a Twitter that I saw him use for the first time ever,
dude,
replying to a fan the other day.
I did.
How was that?
It was awful. I hate Twitter.
Dude, I'm gonna... What's your Twitter thing?
Don't worry about it. Don't.
Right. I won't do it this week. Maybe next week.
All right.
So we're on Twitter at Not Alone Pod, at Not Alone Pod. We're on Facebook, Not Alone Podcast. We're on Instagram, Not Alone Podcast. You can head over to our website, notalonepodcast.com. We have all of the episodes up there. We have bonus, like, show notes and stuff like that, links to different research materials. So take a look there. You can sign up for our newsletter. Whenever we put out a new episode, you'll just get an email with a little description about it. And, that's all I think I got.
Sweet, Sam.
What about you? You got anything? Say something nice.
You're putting way too much pressure on me right now. I don't have anything nice to say.
We'll be back. We'll be back next week. I don't know if this episode's coming out later today on Wednesday or on Thursday. Eventually, we're going to get back to our normal Thursday recording release schedule. Wait, you got something?
Yeah, I don't have superpowers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So I was expecting superpowers, and He doesn't. They haven't manifested yet, or I just don't know how to use them.
That's fair.
But they have yet to be seen.
That's fair.
Yeah, a little bit of a bummer.
The eclipse happened. As many of you know, if you follow us on Twitter, contact was made between humans and an alien species down in Hopkinsville, Kentucky.
Liar.
On August 21st.
Lies.
Fake
news.
What time is it? It's like 1:23 Central Time. Contact was made, and the leader of this alien movement is called Zelsparia, and they are a very just and fair ruler, and I was abducted, and I spent like the whole day just hanging out with them, and welcome them, people. They're beautiful. They're glorious. They're terrifying. They're everything. And we are.
Thank you for that, Sam.
Anyway, cool. Who did it last week?
I did.
You did it last week?
Pretty sure.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
It was on my special.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Remember, whether enjoying a peaceful cruise across the sea, or smuggling papers and chemical weaponry out of a Japanese horror pit, we are not alone.